Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 236, on the efficacy of psychodynamic therapies, with Dr. Jonathan Shedler.
Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast with your host, Dr. Dave. Coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area, Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
One distinguishing feature of psychodynamic treatment is the focus on affect and on emotion. That psychodynamic therapists help patients to attend to and focus on and put into words their emotional life. And this includes contradictory feelings that people are having. It includes feelings that are difficult to talk about or acknowledge. It includes feelings that the person may not initially be aware of. Now, this is not a particularly foreign concept. If you ask, for example, CBT therapists, do you focus on affect? They'll say yes, and they do. But if you look at actual transcripts, what's going on in sessions, it turns out that psychodynamic therapists are doing it a lot more and a lot more often and a lot more deeply.
That was the voice of my guest, Dr. Jonathan Shedler, speaking about his groundbreaking article on the efficacy of psychodynamic psychotherapy, which appeared in a recent issue of The American Psychologist. Jonathan Shedler, Ph.D., is Associate Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Colorado School of Medicine, Director of Psychology at the University of Colorado Hospital Outpatient Psychiatry Service, and founder of Digital Diagnostics Incorporated. He's co-author of the Shedler-Western Assessment Procedure for Personality Diagnosis and author of the Quick Psychodiagnostics Panel for Mental Health Assessment in Primary Care. Dr. Shedler lectures to professional audiences nationally and internationally and consults to healthcare organizations and government agencies. He is also a certified ski instructor and in a former life taught skiing in Aspen, Colorado. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Jonathan Shedler, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Hi.
Well, I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to speak with you. I heard about you and your work during a recent interview with Paul Moore, a newly minted psychoanalyst friend in Ireland, and he told me that you'd published a research study on the efficacy of psychodynamic psychotherapy in the journal The American Psychologist. I was incredulous when I heard this, because psychodynamic approaches, as both you and I know, seem to have gotten such a bad rap in the current era of evidence-based treatment.
They are getting a very bad rap.
Yeah. You know, and so I wasn't totally surprised when I, you know, because I was curious, well, who was motivated to do this research project? And so when I discovered that you, like myself, were a graduate of the clinical psychology program at the University of Michigan, which was pretty psychoanalytic, even though we weren't there at the same time, I was there earlier, you were there later, but I guess it was still pretty psychoanalytic in its orientation at that time. So then the tumblers clicked into place when I realized that that's where you got your training.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, my training is a little unusual. I don't fit easily into one camp or the other. I was actually in the personality and social psychology program at Michigan, as well as studying clinical psychology. So I always had a foot in two camps, one in the research camp and one in the clinical camp. People never really knew what to make of me. The personality and social psychology researchers that I worked with just couldn't for the life of them understand why I was spending time studying psychoanalytic concepts. The clinical folks were never fully convinced that I was really one of them. So people didn't know what to make of me, and that's been largely true throughout my career.
Well, I can really relate to that because people have never known what to make of me either, because I'm all over the place theoretically, as any listeners to this series knows. And so before we get into your paper, which I think is a very important paper and is why I wanted to interview you, tell us a bit more about your background and how you came to do this study.
Well, that's a pretty good question about this study. The truth is that I was dragged into it kicking and screaming.
Really?
I didn't want to do it. I was disenchanted with the academic world and had pretty much sworn off writing journal articles. And what happened is that some senior colleagues asked me to tackle it, and I tried to say no. In the end, I acquiesced more out of a sense of obligation than anything else. That's the honest truth.
Wow. Now, you're at the University of Colorado, though. Can you really swear off of publishing? Can you really swear off of publishing and be on the academic ladder?
Well, I think I've got enough publications in the bag and enough in the pipeline that I'm probably good for a while.
All right. He's bulletproof. That's great. Well, let's get into the details of your study. Now, your study, your research paper in the American Psychologist is based on a meta-analysis. And in case any of our listeners aren't familiar with the term, tell us what's meant by a meta-analysis.
Okay, well, let me back up for a second. I didn't actually do a meta-analysis. What I did is review and summarize meta-analyses that had been previously published that were conducted by other people.
Oh.
So the evidence, the information that I present in my article had already been there all along. What I did that's different is I brought it all together in one place.
Can we say that you did a meta analysis?
Sure.
Okay. Well, again, since you were going over other people's meta analyses, say a little bit about what that is, just in case anybody's not familiar.
Yeah. A meta analysis is a fancy term for something that's actually very straightforward. It's a way of systematically looking at a lot of different independent studies and looking to see if there's looking for common trends, common findings across many different studies. The problem is that the psychological the literature on psychotherapy outcome is very complex, and no single study by itself is necessarily decisive. We've got studies with different populations, different patients, different conditions, different kinds of outcome measures. So what meta-analysis does is it's a procedure for transforming the findings of independent studies into a common metric, into common units that measure the amount of change or the amount of benefit produced by the therapy. And then once you've converted the outcome into these common units, you can then average studies together and compare studies so that you're comparing apples to apples and not apples to oranges. And this is the most reliable and systematic way to look at a large body of literature to see the common threads across a lot of different studies.
Yeah, and I think it really serves to bolster our confidence then about some of the conclusions that maybe one or two studies might arrive at a certain conclusion that XYZ approach is terribly effective. If you get that across a number of studies, you have a lot more confidence in it than if it's just one or two.
Yeah, that's exactly right, that the results of any particular study in isolation are affected by all sorts of things. So the findings of one study by itself are, not necessarily conclusive. When you see the same finding again and again and again across 10, 20, 30, 40, 100 different studies, then you can draw some conclusions with confidence. That's what meta-analysis is.
Yeah, great. Now, in your paper, you note that, and I'm quoting here, there is a belief in some quarters that psychodynamic concepts and treatments lack empirical support, or that scientific evidence shows that other forms of treatment are more effective, end quote. Now, why do you think that belief is so widespread?
David, I could talk for hours on that topic.
Well, don't go on quite that long, but feel free to go into some depth.
Well, let me give you a number of different answers, because I don't think there's a single answer. You know, one is that there's an awful lot of public relations and marketing that goes on under the banner of science. You know, advocates of certain therapies which have come to be identified with the terms evidence-based or empirically supported, have done an extraordinarily good job of marketing and promoting these treatments. And there is a perception in the field that certain particular brands of therapy, certain brand names, have somehow been scientifically evaluated and compared to other therapies as traditionally practiced, say psychodynamic psychotherapy, and that they've been found superior to those therapies. And that's actually a bit of a myth. That is not what the science shows. So, you know, it's necessary to, when you listen to the rhetoric of science, I think it's necessary to very carefully distinguish between what's the actual scientific evidence and how much of it is really advocacy of a particular ideology or a promotion of a particular brand. So, you know, that's a partial answer.
Well, let's just pause there for a moment, and I do want to hear the other parts of the answer as well. But I think it's fascinating that what's supposed to be, you know, science is supposed to be this objective enterprise, and yet the truth of the matter is that there's this kind of political slash marketing dimension that you're referring to. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I think you do have it right. You know, I hate to be the one to say it. It's like
believe me, you're not the first one to say it.
But thank you. I feel better. But you know, it's calling attention to the elephant in the room that everybody has kind of implicitly agreed that they're going to ignore. But you know, we know that there are economic interests involved and there are self-interests involved. You know, people, academic researchers, psychologists and psychiatrists build their careers around a particular treatment approach. And a lot is at stake for them. We're talking about access to grant funding. We're talking about promotions and tenure. We're talking about prestige and influence and power in the field. So people have a vested interest in advocating for a particular approach to therapy, and people associated with certain brands of therapy have advocated very effectively. But you know, unlike in the business world where people say flat out, you know, we're a corporation and the purpose of our corporation is profit, in this field people feel a need to promote themselves using the language of science. So to some extent, I don't want to overstate this. I may be saying it more harshly than warranted, but you know, to some extent the talk is science, but the walk is ideology and self-promotion.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I'm even aware that in some, maybe often the extremes, Sometimes there are terms and names of approaches that actually get trademarked as if they were a brand.
Oh yeah. I mean, there are a lot of brands of therapy that are really kind of proprietary franchises, and people make a great deal of money selling books and workshops and seminars. And, you know, if you want to be, say, a DBT therapist, you know, you need to go through a certain training program, and there are only certain people who are authorized to conduct these training programs, and so on. That's the way it is.
Yeah, and DBT, by the way, is dialectical behavior therapy.
Yes,
right.
And I'm not singling that out. It's just an example.
Right, right. And so we have all of these factors that you've mentioned: getting promoted academically, getting grant money, getting on the workshop circuit, selling books, and then of course there's the pharmaceutical companies. They're big influencers in the mix, aren't they?
Yeah, well, this takes us a little off the topic I thought we were heading toward, but it's an important point. You know, we are in the midst of an enormous debate about the future of healthcare, the future of healthcare reform, and to a large extent in the mental health field, the pharmaceutical companies and the insurance companies have absolutely dominated the national discourse about healthcare reform. I mean, if you think about it, there are special interests with enormous economic power and resources who have a vested interest in getting a particular message out. So, you know, if you're a pharmaceutical company and you've got a study, even a weak study, you've got a study showing that a particular drug is beneficial, you will hear about it. The public will hear about it. If you've got 100 studies showing that, say, psychodynamic psychotherapy is beneficial, we really have no lobby or marketing group or, you know, concentrated economic power with the wherewithal to get that message out. So there's a huge discrepancy between what's actually in the scientific literature and what most people hear about what's in the scientific literature. There's a real bias in dissemination. And obviously, pharmaceutical companies have an incentive to get information out about the benefit of their drugs, and insurance companies have an incentive to get a message out about certain treatments that they want to promote that happen to be brief and inexpensive. And they don't say we're promoting these treatments because we want to pay as little as we can. They say we're promoting these treatments because science says so.
Right, right. And quoting from your article again, you suggest that one potential reason for this bias against the psychodynamic approaches is a, quote, lingering distaste, I like that phrase, a lingering distaste in the mental health professions for past psychoanalytic arrogance and authority. Now, having had some experience with the psychoanalytic establishment, that really resonated with me. It's taken me some time to get over that myself.
Well, it's taken a lot of people time to get over it, and some people never got out of it, got over it. You know, this brings up another issue about why there's an anti-psychodynamic bias in the field. So we talked about self-interest and economic incentives, but there are other things going on, and one is that psychoanalysis in the old days, I'm talking about several decades ago, the psychoanalysis as a profession was guilty of enormous arrogance and hubris. For many decades, it was the only game in town. If you wanted therapy, you got psychoanalytic therapy. And in the United States, psychoanalysis became a medical subspecialty, and the medical psychoanalysts treated non-MDs very badly. They served as gatekeepers. They denied training to people who were interested in it. And it wasn't just the medical psychoanalysts, but clinical psychologists who managed to get psychoanalytic training were the worst gatekeepers of all. And the psychoanalytic community, the psychoanalytic culture, was really very disdainful toward academic research and academic psychology in general. And, you know, obviously this didn't win friends in the academic world. There are a lot of people in the mental health field who grew up, people of certain generations who are kind of at the receiving end of psychoanalytic arrogance and hubris and dismissiveness. And, you know, now that the shoe is on the other foot, I guess understandably, they don't treat psychoanalysis much better than psychoanalysis had treated them.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I felt I was somewhat on the receiving end of that as a student. I felt some of that when I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan. And by the way, I'm very proud to be a graduate of that program. But there were ways in which it felt kind of authoritarian and impersonal at the time that I was there. And it really has taken me many years to kind of come back around. And I mean, I realize that that's a base from which I work, that in fact, I did learn a lot. And even though I've incorporated many other approaches and frameworks and so on, and I'm open to many others, that's sort of foundational. And so that's kind of just been interesting to me in my own career.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. It is a base, and I think there are certain truths of human experience and truths of human psychology that every school of thought, every approach to treatment is sooner or later going to have to reckon with. And as you know, as people coming from different theoretical positions or different backgrounds, you know, get immersed in the ongoing work of treating patients, you know, I think we gravitate back to certain basics. And really, that's what psychodynamic treatment is about. You know, it reckons with these fundamental truths. Other therapy traditions discuss these issues using different language. They've invented new terminology to talk about things that psychodynamic practitioners have been grappling with for generations.
Well, that's fascinating. Now, we've been using the word psychodynamic quite a bit, and that's because it's a very familiar term to both of us, but it can be a pretty broad term, and perhaps not everyone might not have a clear sense of what we're talking about. In fact, you list seven distinctive features of what would be considered to be a psychodynamic approach. Maybe you can take us through those.
Okay. Well, I will. I'll be happy to. But I can boil it down to something much simpler. The purpose of psychodynamic therapy, and by the way, I use the terms psychoanalytic and psychodynamic interchangeably. I don't draw distinctions between them. For some reason, the word psychodynamic seems more acceptable to people, so I use that.
Yeah, yeah. But you're not necessarily talking about people being on the couch, for example, and some of the other ideas that might be sort of associated with psychoanalysis.
No, the terms psychoanalytic psychotherapy and psychodynamic psychotherapy refer to a range of treatments that are based on psychoanalytic concepts and methods, but don't necessarily involve meeting 4 days a week or lying on the couch or being in treatment for many years. Most of the therapies that I reviewed in my article take place once to twice a week, and I think most of the treatments are actually about a year or less in duration.
Well, that's fascinating, and that might be news to some people. Well, at some point, I would like you to go through the seven distinctive features that you list in your article.
All right. Well, let me as a kind of an overarching description, you know, the purpose of psychodynamic therapy is to enhance self-knowledge and self-awareness. It explores those parts of ourselves that we don't fully know, and its goal is to help us to claim or to reclaim those parts of ourselves and our experience that belong to us. That's the overarching goal. And you can distinguish between this and therapies that are aimed at managing symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there's a lot of blurring and cross fertilization between different therapies, but I think there really is a kind of an overarching philosophical dividing line. Do you define the problem that you're trying to tackle in terms of the specific symptoms the person is having, or do you define the problem in terms of how can you help the person to know themselves better so that they can live more richly and fully?
Right.
And depending on where you fall on this, your approach to psychotherapy tends to take a different direction.
Yes.
Well, anyway, you want to get back to the seven
yeah.
the seven features.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Because I thought they were very interesting.
Well, thank you. I didn't mean to avoid your question. The reason for the seven features is that, you know, in this field, it's very easy to get lost in theoretical abstractions. And I thought instead of getting into theoretical abstractions, there's actually research on what specifically goes on in psychodynamic therapy sessions compared to what goes on in other forms of psychotherapy, especially CBT. So there are studies where people have looked at actual session videotapes or audio tapes or transcripts and rated the process. You know, what is it that's going on? What are the therapists doing or not doing? So they could look for, you know, what are the distinguishing features of psychodynamic treatment? And I thought it was important to start my article by getting those features on the table because, as you said, there are so many misconceptions about what psychodynamic or psychoanalytic means that, you know, without describing what actually happens in therapy, I was afraid that people would superimpose their preconceptions on it and come away with the wrong idea.
Exactly.
So, in no particular order, one distinguishing feature of psychodynamic treatment is the focus on affect and on emotion. That psychodynamic therapists help patients to attend to and focus on and put into words their emotional life. And this includes contradictory feelings that people are having. It includes feelings that are difficult to talk about or acknowledge. It includes feelings that the person may not initially be aware of. And this is not a particularly foreign concept. If you ask, for example, CBT therapists, do you focus on affect? They'll say yes, and they do. But if you look at actual transcripts, what's going on in sessions, it turns out that psychodynamic therapists are doing it a lot more and a lot more often and a lot more deeply.
Let me just insert here, CBT, for anybody who's not aware of it, is cognitive behavioral therapy, which is really has become the dominant mode now in terms of most widely practiced and accepted, I guess.
Well, actually, that's not true either.
Oh, okay. Right.
It's the dominant mode in terms of it's the therapy that we hear the most about.
Uh-huh.
But in surveys of actual practicing therapists, what are people really doing in the real world? Even now, a small majority of therapists still describe themselves as psychodynamic or heavily psychodynamically influenced.
Fascinating.
So there's a lot of buzz about how many people are practicing CBT. There are also an awful lot of people who describe themselves to the world as CBT therapists whose training is psychodynamic, and they know fully well what they're doing in their own offices.
Fascinating, fascinating. Okay, well, that's a good start. That's number one. Let's go on to number two.
Psychodynamic therapists focus on the ways that people try to avoid difficult aspects of their experience, the way that people avoid thoughts and feelings that are threatening or uncomfortable. Traditionally, that's what we called analysis of defense and resistance. But those words have fallen out of favor. when you say defense or resistance, a lot of people in and out of the field turn off. But this is actually a common thread in effective therapy, regardless of the brand name, that that human beings are wired to avoid things that are distasteful. It's a protective mechanism. The problem is that the avoidance keeps in place the circumstances that are giving rise to the problem. So psychodynamic therapists actively explore the things that people do to avoid confronting what's difficult.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. A, th- third, and interestingly, in other therapy traditions, newer therapy traditions, there are other ways, other terminology to describe the same thing. But I think this is a common principle of all effective therapy, that it helps people confront what they're avoiding, and that is originally a psychoanalytic idea. The third feature is that psychodynamic therapists identify recurring themes and patterns in people's lives. We know that people tend to recreate the same patterns in relationships with other people, in coping with difficult life circumstances. It's not random. We have certain well-worn paths of ways of functioning, and psychodynamic therapy focuses on recurring themes and patterns, because ultimately the goal of the treatment is to help people rework these patterns and free themselves from them.
Okay, well, that certainly makes sense. That sounds like something that most therapists would agree to.
Yeah, see, it doesn't sound so alien when you just describe it in plain English without the jargon.
Right.
And in the psychoanalytic tradition, there's an awful lot of jargon connected with, I think, that really straightforward idea. We could talk about repetitions and enactments and transference and counter-transference and activates. And it's very easy to get lost in the jargon and then just dismiss the whole thing. But the basic idea, I think, is very accessible.
See, if you had been one of my professors when I was a graduate student, it would have gone a lot easier.
Well, thank you. Since I came from the same program that you did, I think some of the obfuscation,
yes,
and barriers to access may not have been accidental. And going back to what we talked about earlier, I think that's one of the things in the psychoanalytic traditions that's turned off so many people.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, moving ahead with our features, the fourth feature is that there is an interest in past experiences, and this is something that's widely misunderstood. There is absolutely no interest in psychodynamic therapy in the past for its own sake. That's not why people are in therapy, and who cares about the past? The interest in the past, psychodynamic therapists take an interest in the past to the extent that things that have happened in the past shed light on what's going on in the here and now, in the present. So there is an attention to development. How did things get to be the way they are? And how are past experiences being recreated in the present?
Okay, that makes sense.
There's a heavy focus on interpersonal relationships. There is a view in psychodynamic therapy that most of the difficulties that bring people to treatment, in one way or another, are rooted in our patterns of interacting with other people, our experiences of attachment to other people. So psychodynamic therapists are very, very interested in a person's important relationships. What goes on in relationships? How does the person see other people? How do they experience other people? What do they expect from other people? How have they learned to respond in interactions with other people? And that brings us to the sixth feature, which is that one of the relationships that psychodynamic therapists take a special interest in is the therapy relationship itself. And the idea is that to the extent that we create certain kinds of patterns in our relationships with other people, those patterns will appear in one way or another in the therapy relationship itself, so that examining and discussing the therapy relationship becomes a window, a very direct window, into what goes on in the person's interpersonal relationships generally. So let me give you a very, very crude example of that. you have a person who is struggling with anger and hostility, and this is a fairly expectable feature of their interactions with other people, and is giving rise to whatever symptoms have brought the person to treatment. Now, the overwhelming likelihood is that in one way or another, that patient is going to struggle with feelings of anger toward the therapist. And the issue is, what do you do with them when they emerge in therapy? And unsophisticated therapists of any school of thought might consider the patient's anger or hostility or suspiciousness to be an intrusion, an interruption of the work of therapy. A more sophisticated therapist and psychodynamic therapists in particular are trained to do this, will consider the patient's reactions to them, to the therapist, as a source of information about the person. And it becomes not a distraction from the treatment, but a focus of the treatment. Let's see what we can understand about what is causing you difficulty in your relationships with people, beginning with the relationship that's going on right here, right now in the room between the two of us.
Yes, I think that's one of the things that in fact is most distinctive, maybe, about the psychodynamic approach.
Yeah, and that's what we call transference. But other schools of therapy have developed different language to talk about the same phenomenon. So I've been reading the cognitive literature, and cognitive therapists will talk about implicit interpersonal schemas. Now, implicit, right? You're laughing. For listeners who may not know, implicit is basically a code word for unconscious. That is, it's interpersonal patterns that we have maps or templates in our heads about how things go in relationships, but we're not aware of them. That's what implicit means. So we have implicit interpersonal schemas that get activated in the therapy relationship. And that is, old wine in a new bottle.
Yes, yes. Great example.
The last feature that distinguishes psychodynamic therapy from other therapies is that there's a focus on fantasy life, not just not just things that are on the surface of what a person says and does, but what's going on in what's going on in the recesses of their minds. What are the person's hopes and desires and wishes and fears and dreads and fantasies and dreams and daydreams. So there is really a very explicit interest in the life of the mind, in those aspects of the mind that we're usually not accustomed to talking about. And that's another distinguishing feature.
Well, thank you for taking us through all seven of them. I was particularly intrigued by your suggestion that the effectiveness of the non-psychodynamic approaches, such as the widely used cognitive behavioral therapy, may in fact be due to their actually using psychodynamic techniques without realizing it. Maybe we would even say unconsciously.
Well, I think the best therapists are doing it very consciously, whether or not they, they understand that they are following in a psychodynamic tradition. We all know that. Well, let's take these brief manualized therapies that are getting so much attention now. We're being told that the way to do therapy is first you make a DSM-4 diagnosis, and then from that diagnosis there are certain treatments that are empirically supported treatments for that particular condition, and then you treat them by following a step-by-step instruction manual. And the myth is that the active ingredients in the therapy are the things in the instruction manual. But we all know that an awful lot of things go on in the therapy room that are not contained in any manual. Every patient is a unique human being. Every therapist is a unique human being. And the patterns of interactions that develop between them are also unique. So, the question is, are the active ingredients the techniques that are the specific techniques that are included in one or another manual, or are the active ingredients something about the relationship, the quality of the relationship between the patient and the therapist? And in fact, research shows that that the active ingredients are the things that go on, you know, sort of in the spaces and between the lines of what it says in the treatment manual. The good therapists, regardless of theoretical orientation, are the ones that facilitate a process of self-reflection and self-examination and insight and awareness. And this is true regardless of the brand name that the therapist believes that he's offering. And the good therapists pay attention to what's going on in the therapy relationship, and they're very ready to address breaches in the relationship and repair the breaches. So there's some studies of psychotherapy process, specifically cognitive behavior therapy, and of course, as in any therapy, certain patients had better outcomes and certain patients had worse outcomes. Actually, I said that wrong. Certain therapists tended to have better outcomes. And when you looked at what the effective therapists were doing, it kind of went something like this. The therapist would be working with the patient on developing a particular skill, or there might be a homework assignment for the patient to do. And very often, the patient would come back for the next session and not have done it. And at that point, the therapist really has a decision, and one decision is to keep plugging away at the treatment manual and, you know, exhorting the patient to do the homework next time and so on. Or alternatively, the therapist could become interested in what's getting in the way. So you say to the patient, in effect, you know, look, you came here because you wanted help, and yet something is making it difficult for you to take steps to help yourself. Something is getting in the way if you're being able to do the things that we discussed. You know, I'm curious about what's getting in the way. What's going on inside of you? What kind of obstacles are coming up? And if you do that, whether you call it this or not, you're really addressing defense and resistance. Or alternatively, the therapist might take an interest. Is there something going on between us, between the two of us? Is there something about your feelings about me or about being in therapy that are getting in the way? And, of course, that's transference. The most effective therapists were the ones who departed from the manuals and paid attention to the interpersonal process, and then would return to the manual. The question is the action in doing the steps of the manual, or is the interaction in that examination and exploration? And I would suggest that research shows that the action is actually in the exploration.
Yes, well, you and I are on the same page. Personally, I find the manual idea really does violence to the complexity of human beings, to the complexity of what I would call the psyche and of the relationships between human beings. And as you suggest, there's a lot of research to suggest that that's the case.
Yeah, well, I think the manuals, we've really seen a perversion of what treatment manuals were intended to do. When psychotherapy, in the infancy of psychotherapy research, you know, there was an understanding that that therapists were operating according to certain overarching principles, and the way those principles might get played out with a particular patient or in a particular session there was a lot of ways that you might see it. But for research purposes, a sort of a degree of standardization was necessary. So manuals came about as a way of making clear to other researchers, this is how we did the research, these are the steps we followed, so that it could be replicated, so that it could be made public. And the idea was that the manual was an example of one way that a therapist might go about implementing these particular principles. Now the entire thing has gotten turned around, where the manual is no longer an example of one way that a therapist working in this tradition may proceed, but it has become a prescription for how the therapist must proceed. And, I think it's... I think in some cases, I agree with you. It can be very destructive to good therapy, and I think it's an affront to professionals. It's an affront to clinicians.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clinicians are not good clinic master clinicians are not. They don't need to follow cookbooks. They're chefs. They know how to write cookbooks. And you know, the idea that somebody else is going to write out the procedures that they're supposed to follow step by step, I think devalues the knowledge and the training and the experience that it takes to become an effective clinician.
Yeah, I remember some research that was done maybe 30 or 40 years ago comparing schools of therapy, and what the research found was that the effectiveness correlated with the experience of the therapist, with the number of years in which they had been in practice, so that it seemed to be more related to a kind of wisdom that accumulated from experience than the particular theoretical structure that they espoused.
I'd be interested in seeing that study. I know of some studies that seem to show the opposite, that the amount of experience is perhaps not so important. But
well, I hope I'm remembering that accurately. As I say, it goes way back, and if I can find a handle on that, I'll get it to you.
But I think the common thread, I think what most people who look at the evidence open-mindedly recognizes is it's the qualities of the individual therapist that make all the difference. There's far more variance in outcome that's mm-hmm. accounted for by who the therapist is than by the brand name of the therapy they're practicing. You know, and maybe some people acquire an effective way of working through years and years of experience, and some people maybe are born with a gift. But,
yes.
You know, we ought to be spending a lot more time looking at what makes for a good therapist, and less time looking at which brand name is better.
Yes.
The brand names aren't important.
Yes, I totally agree. Now, in your article, you make reference to something you call the dodo bird verdict. What is that, and how does it apply? How does it apply to what we've been speaking about?
I love that phrase. The dodo bird verdict is a reference to Alice in Wonderland. I guess it's a timely reference since we have a new movie out. In Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, the character the dodo bird had a race, and following the race, the dodo bird declared, everybody has won, and all must have prizes. And back in the 1930s, I think was the first time the term entered the psychological literature, an investigator by the name of Rosenzweig reviewed the psychotherapy outcome literature of the time and came to the conclusion that there really was no scientific basis for believing that a particular brand of therapy was superior to any other brand. The finding was that that all legitimate, bona fide therapies provided by competent professionals who believed in what they were doing produced benefits, and it was very difficult to differentiate between the therapies. And you know, here we are many decades later, and the finding really still stands that. It's extraordinarily difficult to show differences between active, bona fide treatments that are intended to work. And, you know, this is something that the people who have a vested interest in promoting a particular brand of therapy tend to downplay or overlook or just outright deny. Because what it says is, again, I'm maybe being a little redundant here, but the brand name of therapy really isn't where the action is. That whatever the active ingredients are, it's something that is not specific to a particular brand.
Okay, so to sum it up then, what are the implications of your research?
Well, one implication is that we ought to be less concerned with horse races between different brand names, you know, who's the winner, and more concerned with, less concerned with validating brand names of therapy, and more concerned with validating therapy processes. What are the ingredients of good therapy? What are the things that good therapists do? So I'd like to see a shift in how we conduct research away from comparing brands of therapy that are tested as a package, and toward looking at what are the psychological processes that we're working with. That's one implication. The other implication, maybe more relevant for practicing therapists and patients, is that there are just certain fundamental truths of human psychology that every therapy approach has to reckon with. And
well, I imagine there's also an implication in there for training.
You're asking me to go way beyond my data.
Oh, okay.
I think there is an implication for training. I think there's been an emphasis in psychology and psychiatry departments on learning particular manualized brands of treatment. And my impression is that these brief, short-term manualized treatments actually don't work so well. Or to be more specific, they work in the short run, but then the patients are back in very short order, complaining of exactly the same difficulties. I think we could train people more effectively if we trained people in sort of fundamental psychological principles of change, so that clinicians were experts in adapting and applying those principles to individual patients, not experts in how many manuals or cookbooks can I master.
I would be tempted to ask you what those principles of change are, but that might be a pretty long conversation.
Well, I'll give you a very short answer to what could be a long conversation.
Okay.
One principle of change is self-exploration. To the extent that we can help our patients or our clients examine those aspects of self that they are not accustomed to paying attention to, will be helpful. And what this means in practice is taking an interest in the huge spectrum of things that people do in the service of avoiding what's comfortable, what's uncomfortable. So good therapists help patients examine avoidances. Another principle of change falls under the category of transference, that interpersonal patterns get repeated in the therapy process itself, and we need to pay a lot of attention to the therapy relationship. So there are two principles of change in relatively straightforward English that I don't think most practicing clinicians would find alien.
Okay, well that's a good program that you're outlining here. Now, the American Psychologist is a pretty prestigious journal. They tend to publish articles that they think is of importance and relevance to the entire profession. Did you have trouble getting your paper accepted by them?
Oh my God, did I have trouble? The review process took well over a year. There were four rounds of reviews and revisions. Some of the reviews I was getting, and I'm really not exaggerating. This is literally true. The review from the peer reviewer came in the form of an email, and I printed it out so I could have it on hard copy. And one review was actually seven single-spaced, small-font pages. And I made all of these revisions, seven pages worth of suggestions and recommendations, and rewrote the paper start to finish and sent it back. And I got back a five-page, single-spaced review from the same reviewers. So it was a very arduous process.
Oh, my goodness. You're to be applauded for hanging in there through that process.
Yeah, either that or it's my masochism that's withstood my own personal therapy.
Well, I hope that the final product didn't get too watered down from from what you intended to say.
Actually, a lot of what was in the original paper did not make it into the final article, but I think the essence of it really came through pretty well.
Yeah, well, I certainly responded to the essence of it. It seemed like an important statement to me. So what's been the response to your paper by the profession now that it's been out there for a bit?
I have actually never seen a response before like the one I'm getting this paper. I've gotten literally hundreds of emails from all over the world, from people, from professionals thanking me for writing this article, and some thanking me profusely. I get multiple emails every single day, and I've actually published a lot of journal articles. This is my third article in American Psychologist, and I have never seen a response like this ever. I think the article really hit a nerve in the profession. You know, at the same time, I know that there are people out there who are having strong reactions to the paper who are not writing the emails thanking me.
Yeah, right.
I've seen some comments on listservs, and you know, I've heard through the grapevine people are trying to discredit my study. They're saying, you know, the studies that I review in the meta-analysis are weak studies. Not true. They don't have control groups. Not true. The entire methodology behind this is flawed. And I think there are just some people out there who have an axe to grind, and the actual scientific evidence is secondary. You know, they're interested in evidence that supports their beliefs, and they're interested in ignoring or picking apart evidence that doesn't support their beliefs. But I think that's a minority of people in the field. I think most people out there are open-minded and are interested in hearing about good science.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that you got such a strong response, and certainly I resonated to it when I heard about it. This has been a fascinating discussion. As we wind down, is there anything else that you'd like to say? Maybe you haven't had a chance to work in here?
I think just one final thought. I think that most people intuitively understand that there's benefit in self-examination and self-knowledge. We've always known it, but it's been very hard to study self-knowledge using the research paradigms that we rely on in this field. But I think now the research bears this out, that we can say that mental health treatment aimed at self-knowledge is evidence-based treatment. And I think that would be a good place to sum it up.
Okay. Well, Dr. Jonathan Shedler, you've been very generous with your time, and I want to thank you so much for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, it's been fun.
I hope you found this interview with Dr. Jonathan Shedler instructive. I really got a kick out of the way I intuitively recognized a fellow University of Michigan graduate before later learning it as a fact. I think we figured out that I graduated about 10 years before he did, so I might have received an even stronger dose of psychoanalytic exposure than he did. In any event, it's clear that we both value the foundation we received at Michigan, and that we both have moved on and broadened our thinking while recognizing the worth of psychodynamic insights. I migrated to Northern California after getting my doctorate at Michigan. That was a time in which a profusion of alternate therapeutic approaches was blossoming in the Bay Area. Everything from Gestalt therapy to bioenergetics to encounter groups to primal scream therapy and more. As time went on, it was interesting to me to see that many practitioners who had embraced these alternative approaches eventually sought out personal psychodynamic therapy for themselves and psychodynamic supervision and training. What had happened was that after a few years of practice, they discovered they needed an approach that offered them more depth and that honored the complexity of the human psyche and human interaction. Also, over the years, I've seen the behavioral position soften so that, as Dr. Shedler notes, cognitive behavioral therapists are often thinking and acting along lines that might be considered rather psychodynamic, whether or not they subscribe to that terminology. Also, I've been fascinated to see how psychoanalytic thought has evolved and been enriched by developments such as attachment theory, among others. If you're interested in reading Dr. Shedler's article for yourself, you'll find it in the 2010 American Psychologist, Volume 65, Number 2.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head.
Hello, everyone. I have a couple of exciting announcements for you. Well, they're exciting for me, and I hope maybe for you too. First, I'm excited to report that Shrink Wrap Radio has received another nod from the American Psychological Association. Someone brought my attention to the fact that Shrink Wrap Radio is used in the current APA Manual of Style in their example of how a podcast should be referenced in an academic paper. It's right there in the latest APA Style Manual on page 210. There are two widely used style manuals across all disciplines, the APA Manual and the Chicago Style Manual. So it's not just psychologists that use the APA Manual. So I'm very tickled by this, and if you haven't got a copy of the APA Style Manual, I took a picture of the page in question, and you'll find it on the Shrink Wrap Radio site under the About Dr. Dave menu. The next exciting item is that my CE course on dreams, that is my continuing education for professionals course on dreams, is now available, and you'll find it under the store menu on the site. This means that all you psychologists, psychiatrists, psychiatric nurses, social workers, and so on can get 4 of your required continuing education units for listening to 6 of my best dream interviews. Who knows? You may have already listened to them. That makes 2 CE courses now available on the Shrink Wrap Radio site, a 6-unit course on positive psychology and a 4-unit course on dreams. Please help to spread the word. Be sure to check out my other podcast interview series at wisecounselpodcast.com, where you'll find an interview with Bruce Ecker on memory reconsolidation and psychotherapy. Now, Ecker is the developer of an approach called coherence therapy, and this interview focuses on the implications of some very recent neuropsychological research, which he feels provide validation for this approach. I think you'll find it fascinating. There are expenses associated with putting this podcast out. For example, I recently had to hire a consultant to bring WordPress up to date, partly in the hopes of not running into the situation of the last podcast, where because of its length, I had to split it into 2 episodes. Well, we didn't get that problem solved, unfortunately, but the money did get spent. So if you haven't made a donation, your help will be greatly appreciated.
Hi, this is forensic psychologist Dr. Stanton Samenow, and you're on the couch with my old classmate, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Dr. Stanton Samenow, who, as you might have guessed, will be my interviewee on the next episode. I'll tell you a bit more about him at the close of the show. Now, once again, we're running long here, so I'll just read 2 emails. First, we hear from Noah. He writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. First, let me say that I love your podcast and appreciate all of the work you put into providing this amazing resource and service. I've been a faithful listener now for about 2 years and have listened to nearly all of the episodes. I emailed you some time ago, a year I should think, to ask for advice on which positive psychology books you would recommend to a curious undergrad psych major. So thanks for that. Your advice was very helpful. At the time of the original email to you, I was trying to put myself on a long-term track towards a career as a Jungian analyst. I have since parted ways with that career, though my underlying motivation has remained the same, and as such, my interest in psychology, particularly depth/humanistic/Jungian/positive/developmental/evolutionary/cognitive psych, is unabated, and as such will surely find expression off the proverbial couch. Anyway, I wanted to recommend an interview for you. This is a bit out of your ordinary range for interviews, though considering your eclectic interests, which seem to be very much parallel to my own, may fascinate you. Derek Jensen is an author and by some considerations a philosopher. He writes extensively about the relationship between man and nature, particularly through the medium of cultural forms, which he differentiates similarly to Daniel Quinn as the dominant industrial cultural paradigm and a primal/paleolithic cultural paradigm. He is without doubt the leading thinker in this field of thought, and to say that a conversation with him is earth-shattering is an understatement. I've read a number of his books, and I, among a good number of others, consider his seminal work to be A Language Older Than Words. That was certainly the most impactful on me. And then Noah went ahead and he gave me a link, and I won't read that right now. He says, I want to also add that I especially enjoyed the Michael Mead interview, who I was surprised, though very pleased, that you interviewed, as his work has been hugely inspirational for me. Also, the Robert Wagoner interview renewed my interest in lucid dreaming, which I gave up on after getting swamped with schoolwork for a prolonged period. I'm using several dream cues, one of which is writing dreaming in black marker on the inside of my right arm to habituate reality checks. Anywho, I don't mean to be long-winded, so in closing, thanks again, and check out Derek Jensen. He will undoubtedly challenge many of your beliefs and expand your mind. And that comes from Noah, who I think might have been in Israel when he wrote it, but is also, I guess, finishing up at the Evergreen State College in Washington State. So thank you for your great suggestion there, Noah, and I'll have to look into it. Finally, here's a short note from Ian, who responded to my thanks for his financial donation. And Ian writes, Dave, graduated Sonoma State College with BA in Sociology in 1973. Longtime member of the cult of Mac, patiently awaiting the iPad in Canada, found some older episodes that I wanted to listen to and thought it was time to pay up. Love the show. Thanks, Ian. And Ian, thank you so much for your financial support, and so glad to hear that you love the show and to hear from a former Sonoma State person. And of course, as you know, it's now Sonoma State University. But back in 1973, when Ian was there, it was in fact called Sonoma State College. We've since grown up. So I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails as usual to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave phone messages at 206-337-0622. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Jonathan Shedler, for sharing his research on the efficacy of psychodynamic therapies. As I mentioned earlier, my next show will be with Dr. Stanton Samenow, who I knew when we were both clinical psychology doctoral students at the University of Michigan. He went on to have a fascinating career in forensic psychology. Among other things, we'll be talking about his book, The Myth of the Out-of-Character Crime. I think you'll find our discussion captivating. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind. We'll be right back.